A year ago, just for perspective, a year ago, there was a blizzard in Peoria. They shut the whole city down, and we would have canceled church, except we had a guest speaker in town, so we're already off to a better start. I know it's bad out there, but it's not like the foot we got last year on this Sunday, so glad you're here this morning. So, 2014, here's the way it started for the Dean family. January 3rd, Kayla broke his leg in two places in a snowboarding accident. He was carving off the lift, and tumbled and broke his leg in two places. And so that's how we started 2014. The Dean family ended 2014 Christmas Day in the emergency room with Jackson for a couple hours, playing football with his brothers. Caleb fell on his shoulder and either dislocated or slightly broke or something. I don't know. So Merry Christmas. That was awesome. Deductible met. All those years of not meeting the deductible, and awesome. So for us, between those two pictures, there's a lot of junk. I'm not sad to see 2014 go away. That's fine with me. And I know for some of you, it was the best year ever. Congratulations or whatever. And but what the turn of the year does is it's really, at one level, it's just a date. I know we can be really cynical. It's just a date, right? It doesn't matter. Nothing changed from last Wednesday to Thursday or whatever days it were. But there is a thing that, like, when you do that, it gives you a time to think about things again. Like, if you're a student, obviously, like, when you start a new semester, everything goes back to zero or 100. I guess everything goes back to 100, right? And then it only goes down from there after that. But for the rest of us, New Year's has become that place for many of us where we can say, draw a line in the sand, new things happening now. And so what's happened in our culture is a lot of people choose to make resolutions out of that. And so I did some research, and from the Journal of Clinical Psychology on January 1st of last year, they put this out. Top 10 New Year's resolutions for 2014. I'll let you guess. What are they? Lose weight is the number one resolution. Exercise, staying fit and healthy is number five. What else back there? Yeah, that'd be stay fit and healthy, five, yep. Get rid of debt, so spend less, save more. What? To read the Bible. I thought you said to get rid of drywall. Like, are you on a mission here, Ted? Like, no, this wasn't to church people, so bigger. New career, maybe? Learn something exciting. No, that doesn't fit. Not. Learn something exciting, yes. Good. Home improvement project is not on the list. Stop smoking, number seven. Yeah, huge. Travel is not on here. Number one, lose weight. Number two, get organized. Yeah, of course. Three, spend less, save more. Four, enjoy life to the fullest. Five, stay fit and healthy. Six, learn something exciting. Seven, quit smoking. Eight is the most interesting one on here, I think. Help others in their dreams. Nine, fall in love. I can't believe nobody said that in either service. And 10, spend more time with family. Okay, percent of Americans who usually make New Year's resolutions. 48, yeah. So, and then infrequently, another 17%. So roughly half of people make resolutions. Percent of people who are successful in achieving their resolution? Eight. Who said eight? Bam! Right on! That's the exact number. Eight. 8%, yeah.
Is that 8% of the 48?
I think that's 8% of people who make the resolutions. This is what I love, people who never succeed and fail on their resolution each year. So this is total losers. How many, what's the percentage? It's 25%. But that's, think about that. I never have success ever at resolutions. I keep making them. This one's fun. Percent of people in their 20s who achieve their resolution each year. 40. So if you're in your 20s, 40% chance you're going to hit your resolution. Percent of people over 50 who achieve their resolution there each year?
4.
14, yeah. So old dog, new tricks. Not happening, right? And then just a couple things. A resolution maintained through the first week, 75% of you. Good job. 25% of people, that means, fail in the first week. I would guess those are the people in the total loser category that never. 71% last 2 weeks, 64% last a month, and then 46 people get past 6 months. So that's I was surprised by that one. Here's the most important part of this whole thing. The study shows that people who explicitly make resolutions are 10 times more likely to attain their goals than people who don't explicitly make resolutions. So my guess is Imago Dei Church is probably fairly cynical, and my guess is most of you don't make resolutions because we're too cool. But the reality is the fact if you make resolutions, as campy as the whole thing is at times, and how cliched and generic it can be, like people don't have things, so they say just very generic, like, oh, I guess I'm going to lose weight and eat healthy and drink less, you know, like without any thought. Despite that, if you seriously take the time to think about your life and to be explicit about this is what I want to change in my life, you are 10 times more likely to actually change than if you just do nothing. That's huge. I was working with a friend the other day out at my house, and he was telling me, like, he said something like, I don't want to live my life without thinking about it. I want to think about what's going on in my life. I don't want to just think about being a father. I don't want to just be a father and husband, but I want to really dig in, like, to how I'm doing and to give thought to my life and where it's going. And he and I were arguing, and I said, I think that's what I love about this church. He doesn't know our church at all. I said, this is what I love about our church, is I said, I think people come on Sunday mornings because you want that. You want to think about your life, and even if you don't use the formal resolutions, you want to think deeply and examine your life. He was saying, no, I think all church people go just to punch the clock, just to say that, hey, I went to church, I'm awesome. And I was saying, well, that might be true for other churches, but for this church, the people I love here, like we do that. Socrates' most famous saying is, the unexamined life is not worth living for a human being. And actually, maybe a more a closer translation might be the unchallenged life is a life not worth living for a human being. And that's what he and I were talking about, is that the idea is I want to be challenged. And I assume if you're sitting here, I assume if you got up this morning and got dressed and drove on the icy roads and made the effort, I assume that you want to live a challenged life. You want to dig deep and think about what is going on in my life and how do I become a better person at whatever level and whatever you mean by that. So that's what we're going to give time to this morning, is at the first Sunday of the year. Next week, we're going to jump into a series. For the first week of the year, I went back and looked because I want to see if sometimes on weeks like this, I go back and look and see, like, what have I said before so I don't say it again because that irritates me. Probably nobody remembers what I said. And I realized that in 7 years of first Sundays of the year, I've spoken two of the seven because usually this is a week where we bring in somebody or that kind of thing. So that was good. I didn't have a lot of material to trample on. So 1 Corinthians 9, you can turn your Bibles, 1 Corinthians 9. We're going to give time this morning to talk about what it means to think about our spiritual life or our life with God, whatever terminology you want to use. It's on page 928 if you're using a pew Bible. 1 Corinthians 9. So when we first started the church, every year on New Year's Eve, I have this it's internal for me. I became an employee of Imago Dei Church on January 1st, 2008, 3 months before we started the church. Before we had our first service, I became an employee. So every year on New Year's Eve is my church anniversary and work anniversary. Anniversary, I don't know what you call it. But so every year, that's the kind of thing. But I was thinking about that because when we started the church, we had a leadership team of 10 of us, and we met every single week. And when we met every single week, we studied 1 Corinthians together. We went through the whole book together. And one of the reasons we did is because if you like church drama, the Corinthian church was messed up. So the whole letter of Corinthians is writing to a church that's totally off the rails, and Paul trying to say, you people, get your act together, all right? And so that's what the whole book is about, which we thought would be a fun way to start the church together, all that. So chapter 9, let me walk you through the argument. Paul, in chapter 9, is talking about his rights as an apostle. And what he's making the case as is, listen, as an apostle, as somebody who spends my life ministering to you, I have a right to be paid for the work I do doing that. And then he gets down further into verse 12 and he says, but Barnabas and I, we didn't use this right. On the contrary, we put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. So what Paul says is basically, I have this ability. I can work off to the side here building tents. And I can make enough income from that that I don't need to take money from the church. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But I don't. But I could if I wanted. I could demand that. And he's working through and saying, but I don't. And then he's talking about in verse 19, he talks about, and we used this when we were talking about the big tent series. I think we looked at those verses in verse 19. And he talks about how I became everything to everyone. To the Jews, I became a Jew to win Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law. Verse 22, to the weak I became weak. I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I might save some. And Paul's just talking about this is how I do it. Whatever I have to do to fit in so that I can talk about Jesus, I'll do it. Brings us down to verse 24, which is where we want to go this morning. Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like a boxer beating the air. No, I strike a blow to my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize. What are your impressions? What jumps out at you? What is Paul after? What resonates? What words jump out? What's the prize? Answer. What's the prize? I'll ask it back. Very Socratic of me. What's the prize? Okay, anybody? What's he talking about here? Training, competing for a prize. Part of it is the metaphor. Part of it is he's working a metaphor here, right? He's comparing his life with God, his spirituality, with running in a race. And when you run a race, there's a prize to be handed out, right? So that's the analogy. So some of it is the analogy, and I think we need to be careful. Some people take that over and like, okay, so there's going to be awards handed out in heaven. I don't think so, personally, not my opinion. That is the reward. Life with God is the reward in itself. It's like marriage, saying you can work for this, there's a prize. The prize is the thing you're working for. Like that, having that good marriage, that is the prize. We don't hand out awards for best marriage of the year at Imago Dei Church. Congratulations, Gills. Wouldn't that be weird and awkward? Not because I just picked on them. That's just who I saw when I looked over there. Anything else from the passage? What's Paul talking about here? Yeah, there's a lot of effort involved. The contrast here, I didn't think of this in the first service, but just reading it again, I've read this several times, but just reading it again, I just got this image of my two oldest boys have been in junior high cross country, right? So in high school cross country, my assumption is that if you do high school cross country, you do it because you love to run. In junior high, you do cross country because the girls are. And so it's hilarious in a high school or junior high cross country meet because you have the kids that are actually running to run the race, and they're actually running to try to win. And then you have the people at the end. Like, there's always a couple girls and a couple boys towards the back who are mostly talking and walking a little bit and jogging a little bit and then talking and then jogging a little bit. And they take the pace at which some of them finish, I could have just walked backwards and done the race. Like, they're not running to win. They're just running aimlessly. They're just out there. I don't know why. I don't know why you do that to yourself if you don't really want, and that's Paul's point, is if you're going to run the race like you're actually going to win it. The word that's kind of, to me, covers this whole passage here, and the word somebody brought up in the first service, is there's intentionality into this. There's an intentionality to this pursuit of God that is here, and he's talking about, do this thing with the intentionality that it needs. I think part of maturity for me has been over the last couple years recognizing what it costs to have the things I want. And I'm not talking about dollars and cents. There is a cost to having a good marriage. There just is. And it's a cost I'm willing to pay. I'm willing to have hard conversations. I'm willing to sit with my wife and say, how's it going in our marriage? How are we doing? What can we do better? I'm willing to pay that cost. there's a cost to trying to raise my boys the best way I know how. They're not going to become the men I hope they become by me just kind of crossing my fingers and hoping that the good Dean Myers genes do their magic and they turn out good. That's just not how parenting works. It works because we'll spend time and we'll have hard conversations and we'll work through some really awkward, weird, hard, what do we do? I don't know. What do we do? And we've come to understand in our early years of parenting that nobody actually knows. There's some theories out there, and people that don't have kids at our age have the best theories. But the people that actually have kids our age or have had kids our age, they just scratch their heads too. And like, we don't know. We just fumbled our way through it too. But we choose to keep working through it. There's a cost to that. There's a cost to having the career you want, right? There's a cost to it. There's a cost to climbing the corporate ladder, and you have to make decisions. And sometimes you're willing to pay those costs, and sometimes you're not. We know this about our lives. There's a cost. If you want to have deep, intimate friendships, you can't have thousands of deep, intimate friendships. You can have a couple deep friendships, or you can have a lot of shallow ones. You choose, but there's a cost to those choices. I was just talking to somebody, tangent. I'll do it anyway. I was just talking to somebody about a church, and they were talking about this pastor, and they said, you know, I love this pastor, but he's just shallow with everybody in the church. I never felt like I knew my pastor, just kept everybody here, right? Well, that's fine. He was trying to keep everybody even in the congregation and be a little bit close to everybody. The other way is there's pastors that get really close to a few people and not as close to others. There's just costs to each one. And part of maturity is recognizing what I want in life has costs. One of the only resolutions I kept from last year, we were with friends last year on New Year's Eve and talking about what we hope for 2015, and pretty much everything didn't go at all like I thought it was going to go. But the one thing that I said I was going to do last year, New Year's Eve, that I actually did is I ran my second marathon. And I told Jennifer after the second one, I don't know if I'll do any more full marathons because there is such a cost involved. There's when you get towards the end of marathon training, I don't know if you know this or not, but you go out and you run 16 miles, and that's just Tuesday, right? And then on that Friday, you're going to run 20, 22 miles. Like, and you don't do that quickly. That's hours. Like, so in the last week, in the big week, it's about 3 weeks before your marathon is the big training week. And in that week, you'll spend 10 hours running, 8 hours running. It's a lot of running. And last year it happened that week fell on our spring break trip. And I told Jennifer, like, I hated that on spring break when I was supposed to be relaxing, I had to get up and run every day. And I felt like I was missing out, and it made me sad. And I don't know if I'll want to do that kind of training again, because there's a cost to that. And I recognize that as much as there's a joy in doing a marathon for me, and as much as there's a joy of running into a stadium and seeing my face on the screen and all that, I don't know that I have it in me to pony up that cost again. And so, you know, we know this. I'm not telling us anything we don't know, right? Right? That's part of what it means as we grow up. And part of it is looking in the mirror and recognizing this is the cost. And what Paul's saying is, I think we know that about parenting and our jobs and exercise and whatever else there is in our lives. We know those things. But then when it comes to our spiritual lives, I think often we think that if we just show up and sit at church, then we're good. And what Paul's saying, and I think Brad said this really well, like, what Paul's saying is that it takes work. Like anything else I want in life, if I want to walk closely with God, there's a degree of work on my part. This past year, here's what we know about our church. This past year, we did a survey of the church, and we asked you all to do the survey. And I can't remember, first of all, thank you. We were looking for how many people to take the survey. I'm glad you're in here this service. Was it 120-ish we were looking for? And we got like 123. So well done. We did just enough, right, to get a good sample size. That was the goal, is to get 123. So we did the survey. Now, I'm going to say a couple things about the survey. I have sat twice now with our, I've sat once with our leadership team and one with our formation team and gone through the survey results, and then Dustin and I have gone through them together. And so I've gone through the results several times. In the coming months, we will probably have a time where you can sign up and come, and I'll walk through. For those of you that want really all the statistics and all that stuff, I will sit down and go through that with a group of people that want to do that. I'm not going to bore you all with that, right? There's a 100-plus page document that explains the 40-page slideshow of stats. There's a lot of stuff there. So let me just say it. I want to give you a couple headlines. The first one, I couldn't say some of these things while you were taking it. That survey didn't fit our church very well, right? There were some things on that survey that I hoped you all answered wrong, right? So, for example, one of the questions on the survey was, do you hand out Christian literature and have bumper stickers on your car? Or something along those lines. And the test wanted you to say yes. Thank God you didn't, right? So, like, that's just not how, we're not the kind of church that promotes, go up and hand somebody a pamphlet and run away and hope that they start coming to your church. That's just not how we roll, right? Right? All right? And so some of you took those and you're like, this was weird. Yes. All right? Fine. Glad you failed. Congratulations. So couple headlines. All right? But what I was going to say there is, but despite some of the weirdness, we bought it off the shelf to customize the surveys, tens of thousands of dollars. Despite all that, Lucas and I had a conversation about, despite that stuff, I felt like we got to the stuff that we really wanted to know about our church. There were some things that I had gut suspicions about. Just here's where I think our church is at, and I think mostly it confirmed as a leadership team what we probably thought about where we are as a church. So here's the headlines. Two or three. I don't know what I'm going to say and how you decide which ones are headlines. The first headline is this, all right? Not only did we take a survey, but lots and lots of churches across the country take the same survey across all kinds of denominational types. And they compare all of them together. And comparing us to all the other churches that took this survey in a certain time frame, I can't remember what the exact dates were. The good news is, and it made me sleep a lot better at night, is you all like this church. That when it comes to, so the number, I can't remember the exact numbers right now, and I didn't want to get too steeped in stats this morning, but roughly, if you survey churches, most of the time, about 20% of your people identify themselves as not entirely happy with the church in some way or another. I like the church, my family's always gone there, blah, 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 blah. The pastor's kind of a tool, but he'll leave in a couple years and it'll be better. You know, like that kind of thing, because I've heard people say that very thing. Has anybody else heard people say that? Yeah, okay. Especially Methodists say that, it seems like, because they know their guy's leaving in a couple years and they're just waiting, right? And hoping that the lottery comes up big next time. So our number was about half of that. It was really, compared to other churches, a really small. Most of you are entirely gruntled. Only a few people, and there was good reasons. And some of, when we even get in the survey some reasons, like here's the things that are upsetting some people, and good information. So that to me was a real positive. Like what we're doing seems to be resonating with people. This is a positive / negative tied together. Okay. The survey said that compared to other churches, many, many more, it's not quite twice, but it's close, of our people identify themselves as spiritually stuck. That when asked about your spiritual journey, a big percentage of us, compared to other churches, identify ourselves as, in my spiritual journey, I'm just stuck right now. And I don't know how to move forward. And I don't know that the church is helping me move forward, and I don't know what to do, and I just stuck, right? And so more of our people, which again, not a surprise. I feel like we know that about us. Like, yeah, that describes our people pretty well. I think that's why, because the flip side of that is that, again, higher than most churches, you feel safe here being stuck. That when you say, I'm stuck spiritually, sometimes in some churches, what happens is when we confess, hey, I feel stuck, the response is, now I feel shame, now I feel judged, now I feel like I'm not doing enough, whatever we feel, we don't feel like it's okay to be stuck. And to me, the good news, the headline, is in small groups, in conversations, in here, wherever you are in this church, mostly when you say, I'm just really stuck spiritually, whether it's this idea or this practice or this thing, what the survey told us is that when you feel that way, you feel like, boy, Imago's a place where it's safe to be stuck. It's okay. And people are gracious with me. And that's, oh man, that made me so happy. Not that you're all stuck. Not that lots of people are stuck, but that there's grace here. And that was the good thing. So those are the two, the positive headline, the positive / negative, and then the one that I think that we were fearful of is when it comes to, the most negative part of the survey was this. If we're going to look in the mirror and be honest about who we are and be mature and weigh the costs. The survey says that when it comes to spirituality, what it means to be spiritual, what it means to walk with God, outside of Sunday morning, we aren't. And we don't know what to do. That we love what happens in here. We love the discussion. It's thought-provoking. All those things show up. But when it comes to, do you read your Bible? Do you pray? Do you spend time in silence and solitude, meditation, spiritual disciplines? We just aren't. Now hear me in this. This is not me wagging my finger and saying, you people, that would underlie the safe part, right? That's not what I'm saying, because I think it's a two-way street. I think we're not, and I don't think that, all on my part, I don't think I've done a good job or we've done a good job as a church of helping and giving you tools to do that. Both sides. And so part of this thing and part of me looking at this passage and thinking about the intentionality of it is wrestling with that fact about our church. How do we as a church then move on? Now let me sound the grace note. I think the reason why I expected that result is here's what I tell people that don't know our church about our church, is that we're young and that many of us used to be Lutherans, Catholics, Baptists, Charismatics. We all used to be something. And part of the journey is when you're growing is to reject what you used to be and then to replace it with what you are. And that's the point at which many of our people are stuck, right there. I used to be that, and I don't know what I am over here, but I know I'm not that. And so one of the things that I'll show you in just a minute is one of the things as a church for us moving forward and what I think it means in training for righteousness like Paul's talking about is we've got to get better at that, of having that conversation. That's, you're going to start hearing that coming up more and more. And so what we're talking about then is not trying harder. I'm not asking you all to sign up for a year-long Bible reading plan and start trying harder. That's not what we're after. And I stole this title from John Ortberg's book, The Life You Always Wanted, still to me one of the best small group books. If you're looking for one, it's probably 15 years old now or 10 years old. And John Ortberg says, often what we do when we come to these kinds of things is we just start trying harder. I'm gonna start praying for 40 minutes every day. And that lasts for like 2 days, and then we fail, and then we feel like losers, and we're done. And he said, it's not like that. It's more like training. So last winter, I signed up for a marathon in April, as I was telling you. And the reason I signed up for that particular marathon is because in February, when you have the winter we had last year, there are lots of good reasons not to run. Sideways snow, 4-degree high, my bones hurt, television. Everything seems like a good reason not to run in the middle of the winter. But for me, putting something on the calendar, that motivates me. If I'm just left to run, if you just say, you know, Charlie, just run, I will run a little bit. I won't run that much because I'm lazy by nature. But when I put a race on the calendar, I know that I have this race coming up and I have to prepare for it and I don't want to embarrass myself at the race. And so any more than I'm going to by wearing running shorts anyway. I need to get out and train. So like even last winter, when there would come days where it just really was not feasible, you know, it wasn't safe to be out running on the roads where cars could slip and then hit you and die. Like there were days I just could not do it. I don't throw my hands up and say, well, I tried and it's over. No, the next day I try to get out and, okay, I'm training. I'm not trying to do better. I'm training for something. So I missed a day. That's fine. I get it the next day, you know, and you just keep plodding forward. And when we talk about a life with God or spirituality or what Paul is talking about here when he talks about running a race and all that stuff is training, not trying. This is the idea. Let me use this analogy. In marriages, when let's say there's a couple and they have a tragedy happen. A sick child or something, or really, really bad circumstances. Two things happen to a marriage. Either the marriage gets stronger or the marriage falls apart. And in my experience, it's not the event that decides that. What decides what happens at that juncture is all the stuff back here that that couple did. Did they train for this moment? Did they build intimacy? Did they learn how to communicate? Did they do the things that trained themselves to be the kind of people that could handle adversity? And if they did, when this crisis comes, they'll depend on all their training, all the things they've learned when times were good, and they will thrive in that moment because they'll be hanging on to each other and they'll get through it. And if they haven't done the work, if they haven't counted the cost, and if they haven't decided to pay what it costs to have a good marriage, if they haven't done all that work, when they get to that moment, they will not have the tools it takes to survive. That, to me, is what training in spirituality looks like, training in righteousness looks like. Is it's training so that when life happens, I have the resources. I've developed practices of meditation and silence and solitude and prayer. I've developed a life that will get me through those hard times. That's what it looks like to train. And in that mindset, if I say part of my training this year is I'm going to start, let me just pick something. I'm going to start doing the prayer of examine every night. I'm going to pray this one prayer every night before I go to sleep. That's going to be my discipline that I'm going to try to practice. If I'm trying and I forget to do it on January 4th, then on January 5th, I quit and I feel like a failure. If I'm training myself and I forget on January 3rd, on January 4th, I say, well, forget about it. I'm training for something. I just pick it up and do it again. And if I forget for a week, I pick it up and do it again. If I forget for a month, I pick it up and do it again, because it's not about trying and checking it off a list. It's about training myself for something. And if I miss some training, I just pick it up where I left off and keep going forward. And so there's ways that we need to train in 2015. And I want to do two kinds of training. I'm going to talk first about corporate, what we're doing as a church, and then I'm going to leave it to you to wrestle with your own thoughts in just a minute. So some of the ways that we're training as a church, starting next week, one of the things that we'll be doing this year that I'm really excited about is we're going to start next week teaching the Gospel of John. It's going to take at least 38 weeks to get through this series. And we're going to take breaks for Advent and Lent and maybe just a break in the summer just because. And there'll be little spots where we take little breaks. But mostly we're going to be plodding through the Gospel of John. Likely, Dustin and I were mapping it out a couple weeks ago, and likely it's going to spill over into 2016. So next year, right now, we'll still be in the Gospel of John. Hopefully we'll be past the halfway mark. But we're going to spend a lot of time this year in the Gospel of John. Little geekdom there. Dustin and I went commentary shopping. So that's the shelf of books for John. If you are so inclined, the one that's going to be the primary source is the one that the glare's hitting, the blue one. I intended to do that with my camera to put the glare on the book that I was choosing. It's by Ben Witherington. He's the guy that did the book that we use for 1 Peter. And so that's going to be our primary source. That's the one I'll read cover to cover. I will not read the Brunner book cover to cover. I promise you that. There is a high cost to reading that book in terms of years of my life. And the red ones down there, that's one commentary, two volumes of one commentary on John. That's ridiculous. Anyway, I've only just appealed to about 3% of you that are interested in those books, so let me move on. So part of this is what we're going to try to do. We won't have it ready this week, but soon we're going to try to give you resources in your small groups or even just discussion questions to work through leaving here as a way to give you something during the week to chew on if you need things between Sundays, and so we're going to be doing that. We're going to continue to serve in all the ways that we serve. The breakfast, the neighborhood here, the garden, the orchard. This year, we're trying to take two teams to Honduras. Most years we do one trip. One year we did two. We're going to try to do two again this year, but you have to listen, all right? This is important. If you want to go to Honduras this year, if you're thinking about going to Honduras, if you're just kind of interested in going to Honduras this year, applications are due tomorrow. So we were announcing it during Advent. You may not have heard it because of the insane Christmas carols that wouldn't stop. But applications due tomorrow. So you need to get online, fill those out, get them in. Even if you're interested, you can back out. You can't sign up later, but you can back out later. So if you're interested, if you have questions, talk to Corey Brown. He knows dates, right? All right, Corey knows dates. He can give you. We're looking at a spring trip and a summer trip. Right now, we have 11 people that have signed up to go this year, which is a great number for us. Usually we're between 10 and 12 every year. 11 people, but they're evenly split between the two dates, which isn't a big enough team to do either date. So we really would like three or four more people on each trip that would make us able to do two. And I don't know yet how much money we raised through our offering at the end of the year, but I think we're going to be close to paying for the construction costs and all that stuff. So that's good. You're going to hear, like you've already heard, an emphasis on spiritual disciplines, and we're going to try to help and give tools to that wherever we can. Our leadership will continue to evolve. We started last year a process in our leadership teams of trying to evaluate every January or so of who should be on leadership and who needs to step off. And so this is going to be true every year for us as a church 7 years in, that there will be people who have served a long time at Imago who will be stepping out of leadership, and there will be people coming in. And that'll be happening in the next couple months. And once things are a little bit more finalized, we'll let you know who the leaders are of the various teams and stuff. But that's happening right now. And then the last thing that's going to be a big step for us, and it's two things. It's a step for us and a step for me, is what often happens in ministry is pastors work a lot, and it's not so much the hours. I'm blessed that I get to lead a church where I don't feel like the expectation is I kill myself every week, but I try to do my job well. And for me, as I get older, what I notice more and more at 41 is there's an emotional cost to being a pastor. There are days where in the same day, I have to switch gears. Not just me, all pastors. Like there are days where in one moment of the day, you're talking to somebody who's grieving or in a crisis, and the next one, you're trying to help somebody plan a wedding, and you're supposed to be celebrating, and you have to hold both of those things inside of you sometimes. And sometimes it's just exhausting. And so what often happens in ministry is pastors, and not just pastors, but people in other ministry-type jobs, they keep going, and they keep going, and they keep going, and they feel burnout, but they keep charging through. And oftentimes, vacations aren't even enough because you just hardly get a time to even stop thinking about things. Like, I've been off since Christmas Eve, and yet I've been thinking about this for the last at least 5 or 6 days and working on my message in my head and things. And so beginning last year, Eric Potter took a sabbatical with Youth for Christ. I think that part started some of the conversation, and Vicki Brown started some of the conversation. So we've been in a conversation in the leadership. And this year, in August, September, October, I'll be taking a sabbatical for 3 months. And that means that I will shut off my church email and really kind of disappear for a while and just rest and be and not try to think about church, which I hope to get to at some point. And I've told there's a team that's working with me and talking about what does that look like. And I've told them it feels a little strange. I've never done anything like this before. And the idea is, I want you all to hear this. I'm not burnout. I'm not at the edge of like, oh, I want to get out of ministry. That's not where I'm at. But the desire of our leadership is that we don't get there, that we don't get to the place where I'm run so ragged that we just eventually, because that's what I've seen my friends do it. They just finally throw up their hands and say, forget it, I'm out of here. And I don't want to get there. And so so that'll be happening later in the year. We're still working out the details as to what that'll look like. And we're going to talk more about it as we get closer and what that looks like. What's, to me, the good thing for the church is I have a friend who planted a church in Kansas City. And eventually, as the founding pastor, he left that church because he's like, as the founding pastor, there got to be a point where I was in the way of what the church needed to do. And so it will be interesting for me to figure out what I do to just refresh my soul in those times. But the goodness I feel for the church is that as the founding pastor, I've had my hands on the wheel since the church began. And to take my hands off the wheel for 3 months and to say, you know what, I'm not driving this thing. And I can be a little bit of a control freak in certain ways, not in others, but in some ways I can be a control freak. And so to take my hands off the wheel and say, don't call me unless it's dire, it's huge for me, but I think it's good for the church. And so we'll be working through that as the year goes on and communicating with you clearly. Just wanted to start putting it out there, and we'll talk about it more later. So the questions I have for you guys is this, is as you think about year 2015, what does it mean to train yourselves in 2015? What is God calling you into? And I recognize in a church as diverse and as big tent as ours, this may look differently for everyone else. So I'm just going to put some prompters up there, and then Danny's going to play some music, and we're going to be silent for a couple minutes before we take communion. And the questions are, where is God leading you in training? As you think about your life, how do you think? How do you challenge yourself this year? Now, I want to say a couple things. If you're like me, you tend to make big goals and not meet them, and I've been trying in my life over the last couple years to set smaller goals, ones that I can actually achieve. And so I would suggest if you've never practiced meditation before, don't start with, I'm going to start meditating 4 hours a day because I heard the Dalai Lama does that, right? That is a bad goal. You will fail in that, right? He's spent his life practicing meditation to get to that point. And so I would suggest if that's where you want to go, is I want to meditate on scripture every day, I would start with like 5 minutes, you know, and move up from there. Set yourself goals that you can actually achieve. And so maybe there's some arenas of spiritual discipline that you need to lean into. Maybe there's some ways of praying and reading and that stuff. For me, every couple years, not this year, 2016, I try to read the Bible cover to cover. I like to do that. I like to read a chronological Bible. And so that's what I do every couple years. And I don't know what it is. Here's one. I'll just throw one out there. Maybe for 2014, you set a goal to read John a couple times. It would fit with what we're doing here. And then on Sunday mornings, when I ask for comments and questions, you can look brilliant, which is the wrong motivation to do this, right? It's just a little byproduct, all right? So maybe that's it. Maybe just to say, I'm gonna really try to read the Gospel of John a couple times throughout the year and that kind of thing. Or I'm going to try to do a certain kind of prayer. And if you need help in some of these things, Dustin and I are so happy to help you and give you ideas and thoughts. Maybe there's ways that you need to serve. Maybe it's time, you've been here for a while, you have kids in the ministries, and you need to start serving there. Maybe you need to serve at the breakfast. Maybe this is the year that you need to go to Honduras, that God's been working at you. What we find, it seems, is that people that sign up for Honduras often say something like, you know what, God's been working on me for a couple years about Honduras, and I keep thinking about it, and I just haven't actually signed up. And so maybe this is the year that you sign up to go to Honduras. And then, of course, always, as we turn the new year, I know many of you are thinking about your finances. Your paycheck has changed this year for whatever reason. And it's a time where you've been thinking about budgeting and that kind of stuff. And as part of that, I would hope that you think about your giving to the church. And I'm not saying this as just a, hey, give money to the church because we need it. It's always good. But as a spiritual discipline, as a, hey, this is what God is calling me into and what my responsibility is, from that side, what is God asking of you? We've said in our resource team at times, like, the beauty of online giving is you don't have to think about it. The curse of online giving is you don't ever have to think about it. And so I'm asking you, especially if you do online giving, that maybe you haven't thought about it in a couple years and you need to go back and revisit, hey, this is what we're doing and this is not enough, this is too much or whatever. Maybe this is a space and a time where you need to evaluate your life and where God is leading you at this time of your life. So we're just going to be silent. I'm going to give you a couple minutes. I wanted to give you a lot more time, and then I had a whole lot more stuff I wanted to say. So we're going to spend just three, four minutes. Danny, go ahead and play. I'm going to pray us into a silence. And during that silence, just to ask yourself, where is God leading me in 2015? What is the intentionality? How do I train for righteousness like Paul's talking about? And even to write some ideas down. I'll say this too. I'll say it now instead of at the end. Personally, I feel like when I do these kinds of things, what helps then is to follow this up with a conversation with my spouse, with a trusted friend, with a small group, with somebody that helps me flesh this out. Because sometimes I can set goals and I need my spouse and my closest friends to say, really? That's your goal for this year? You're going to run a double marathon this year? You're an idiot. You said last year you weren't going to do that again. So, you know what I'm saying? Like, we need those people in our lives to help bounce things off us that know us and can give us reality checks. Or the opposite side, like, you know, like, oh, you're going to run a 5K? That's lame, all right? For me, that would be lame. I'm not criticizing. As some of you, that would be an awesome goal. For me, that would feel like failure, all right? So, that to me is helpful. That's where my community is a helpful place to bounce ideas off of. And so maybe out of this today, this afternoon, this evening, later in the week, you can have a conversation. Let me pray us into that, and then we'll be silent, and then I'll just stand up and lead us in the Apostles' Creed when it's time for communion. God, help us to take our spiritual lives as intentionally as we take the rest of our lives. Help us to think about the ways in which we're training ourselves for righteousness, so that when we find ourselves in spots in life where things are hard, we've created in us what we need to get through it. God, help us as we think about goals. That statistic just kills me, that we're 10 times more likely to become something if we've been intentional about thinking that. And so God, help us to be as intentional about our spiritual lives as everything else. Help us in this moment to not get distracted about what's for show or what other people want of us, but what you're calling us into. And I recognize in this room that that's probably different for so many of us and what you're calling us to. And so help us to be sensitive to your spirit in this moment and to know, and then help us as we move forward in that. And help us to, God, so many of us have such a trying mentality, and help us to think of it as training. And that when we fail, that it's not failure. It's just training, and it's part of the process, and to keep moving forward. God, the prize for us is we want to walk with you. And we want to become more like you. We want to see more of the Imago Dei restored in us to become more human. And so that, to me, is a prize. And so help us in that. In your name I pray. Amen.